Our reading today is from Exodus, which won't surprise you if you've been here for a few weeks. It's Exodus chapter 12, and it's verses 1 to 14. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbour, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you must take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. The same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire with the head, legs, and internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some of it is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. On the same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is a day you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance." In 1998, Simon and I went to the cinema. We had been before, and we have been since, so it wasn't like a particularly outrageous thing to do. But the film we saw did stick with us for quite a while. It wasn't because it was a brilliant film or because the story was outrageously different, but it was basically because of the first 24 minutes of the film. The film was called Saving Private Ryan. Don't know whether anyone has ever seen it. And it was about a group of soldiers, American soldiers, who were sent to search for a paratrooper, who was a United States paratrooper. And they were sent to search for him because all the other members of his family had been killed in World War II, and they wanted to save this one son so that one son could come back from the war alive. But the reason that the first 24 minutes stuck with us is because these 24 minutes depicted the Omaha beachhead assault, June 6, 1944. And if you've seen the film, you will not forget it, because basically it starts off with the soldiers in their boat, ready to land on the beach. And some of them are nervous, and some of them are excited, and some of them are seasick, and some of them are smoking, and they're doing all sorts of things, just not wanting to think about what's coming up. And then the front of the boat starts to lower down as they get to the beach. And it's only lowered a few centimetres when bullets start to come into the boat. And from that moment on, there's chaos. There's bombs, there's bullets, there's explosions, there's death, there's maiming for the next 24 minutes of the film. And you have surround sound, so you're a bit involved in it. You're in the middle of it. And after about 10 minutes, you're thinking, this is really, like, well depicted. After 15 minutes, you're thinking, please, make it stop. Just make the bombs stop and the killing stop and all the death stop. By the end of the 24 minutes, you can't think of anything else but that opening scene of the film. To be honest, the rest of the film for me is a little bit of a blur because I was just shocked by how awful it was. When Simon and I came out of the cinema with our friends, we felt bruised and battered by what we'd seen. We felt the world was going to come to an end. In fact, a car backfired in the car park, and we just thought it was a bomb going to land on us because we were so affected by what we'd seen. And, you know, I haven't experienced that feeling since that day. It's not often that you experience something like that. Until that is, I reached Exodus chapter 12. And I started to see how the Egyptians might have felt at that time. Because you see, since we last encountered Moses, if you remember, and his first attempt to release the Israelite people, which didn't go so well, we've had 9 plagues, 9 exhibits of God's power, 9 disasters that have come upon Egypt. There has been the plague of blood, which affected all the water in Egypt. Blood was everywhere, it says, even in the wooden buckets and stone jars. We've had a plague of frogs, which started in the Nile, but eventually came into the houses, on the people, and into the ovens. We've had a plague of gnats, which came from dust and covered the people and animals everywhere. This was followed by a plague of flies, which swarmed into Egypt, ruining the land. Then we had a plague of livestock, which killed all the Egyptian horses, donkeys and camels, cattle, sheep and goats. As if this wasn't enough, we had a plague of boils, which started as a fine dust but caused festering boils to break out on all people and animals. Then we had a plague of hail, which was not just sleety hail or a bad day. It was the worst storm in all the land of Egypt since it had become a nation. Then we had a plague of locusts, which came in on the east wind, covering all the ground until it was black, and devouring all that was left after the hail, which had destroyed most things. And finally, we've had a plague of darkness, which was so dark that no one could see anyone else or move around for 3 whole days. 9 devastating plagues in quite a short period of time, really. And it may not have been Saving Private Ryan, it may not have been the horrors of World War II, but I bet the Egyptian people actually felt just as bad, battered and bruised. I bet they were just thinking what was going to be around the next corner. I bet they were hoping the next plague would be the last plague they ever saw. I bet they were actually waiting for the world to end because things had been so awful. Because let's face it, since the God of Israel had arrived in their land through Moses, there had been nothing but a bombardment of earth-shattering, life-changing, world-altering events, the likes of which no one had ever seen before. And you know, when you think about it, it's not really that surprising, I guess, is it? Because, in effect, in the last 4 chapters since we encountered Moses, the Egyptians have been at war. They've been a country at war. Not with an enemy that they'd chosen to encounter, not with an enemy they could see, not with infantry on the beaches of Normandy, but with God, the Lord, the God of Israel, the one Moses had said he'd come to represent, the one the Israelites had said they wanted to worship in the desert, the one that Pharaoh had chosen to ignore from the beginning, the Lord, the great I Am. They were at war with God, a war between the self-appointed God of Egypt, Pharaoh, and the all-powerful God of Israel. And this is how it had been played out. God would send a warning. He'd say, if you don't do this, if you don't let the people go, then there will be this plague. And Pharaoh would refuse to listen. I don't know your God. And then God would send a plague. And Pharaoh would relent. Oh, please, please. Oh, how awful. I'm so sorry. I'll let you do anything. Please take the plague away. So God would take the plague away. And Pharaoh would refuse to keep his word. So God would send a warning. And so on, and so on, and so on. God and Pharaoh face to face. Until all the Egyptian slave drivers, all the Israelite slaves, all the land of Egypt could do was to stand back and watch and just hope against hope that somehow they would survive this terrible ordeal that was sweeping through their land day after day after day. And then comes warning of a final plague, a truly awful plague. A plague that it seems would change the face of history forever. a plague the Egyptians feared more than any other, because it was actually a plague that they themselves had visited upon Israel some 400 years before. It was a plague that would end up devastating Pharaoh and his family and every family in the land of Egypt, except the Israelites. The plague was known as the plague of death, which was visited upon all firstborn sons. But unlike all the plagues that had gone before, this is where things actually take a different turn in the passage. Because as God calls Moses to announce the final plague to Pharaoh, as he tells him to take the final warning to the self-appointed God of Egypt, he also calls Moses to do something else. He also calls Moses to go to the people, to go to the whole community of Israel, and to give them instructions. Very specific instructions. Very interesting instructions about this final plague. And the instructions are these: to take a young lamb, a lamb without defect, a lamb without any fault, a lamb without broken bones, a lamb which is just right for each family and each household to consume, and to keep this lamb, to keep it safe until twilight, and then to slaughter it, and to take its blood and to paint it on the door frames of the Israelite houses, along the tops and down the sides, so that everyone can see it. And then to take the rest of the lamb, all of it, and to roast it. Not eat it raw or boil it, but to roast it, and to eat every single part of it. And if every single part of it was not eaten, to burn the rest, so there was none left over. And all this was to be done while waiting to leave Egypt, while dressed in travelling clothes, wearing shoes, ready to make the move to go. Very specific instructions. In fact, they're instructions which needed to be carried out to the letter. In fact, they are vital. In fact, they're crucial, because they're instructions given directly from God to his people. And it's only when these instructions are carried out specifically as they're told to be carried out that the people of Israel will not only be ensured of safety as the destroyer travels throughout Egypt that night, but they will also be ensured of liberation as the next morning they are ordered by Pharaoh to leave Egypt forever. Very specific instructions. Instructions which spoke of freedom. Instructions which spoke of freedom from the shackles of Egypt, freedom from the shadows of another nation, freedom for the people of God, finally. Instructions that would be carried out not only there and then, but the next year and the next year and the next year and the next year forever. Instructions that would be known as the Passover. The Passover. The moment the people of God were finally freed to live as God intended them to live. The Passover, the defining moment in Israelite history. These were the instructions, and this was the plague which finally came together to break Pharaoh's back and to bring the Israelites freedom from slavery. Now, when I read this passage and look at these instructions, my question is, why? Why? Why was it this moment that was to bring freedom? Why was it this plague that would ensure release? Why was it these instructions which would be remembered forever? I mean, there'd be plenty of other plagues, hadn't there, that had been devastating in their effect, all the water turning to blood. Well, that's not healthy, is it? All the livestock dying. Well, that can't mean you're going to survive for very long, can it? Not being able to see anyone else or move around. Well, that's not a great way to live. There have been plenty of other plagues for Pharaoh to give in to. And to be fair, all the other plagues had far greater and obvious devastating effects. A hailstorm that destroyed everything in its path, people and animals and plants and everything. Locusts that devoured all that was left, so there was nothing. Gnats which came from dust and covered everyone. Pretty good signs that it's more than human beings that are working here, wouldn't you say? Pretty good signs that God is an all-powerful God. There'd been plenty of powerful, dramatic plagues over the last little while. So why the Passover? Why the one plague that arrived silently? Why the one plague that arrived in the middle of the night? Why the one plague that came about when everyone was asleep? Why the plague that on the outside seemed the least dramatic of all the plagues? Well, I guess there's a couple of reasons. For a start, this was the one plague which Pharaoh could do nothing about. Oh, I mean, you know, granted he was pretty helpless for most of it, wasn't he? Couldn't do anything about anything. But the Passover was the one plague where he was truly beaten. You see, in all the other plagues, he could either get his magicians to perform the same acts, which I don't know whether he realised were actually hurting the people, but even so, he could perform the same acts as God, or he could ask Moses to take the plague away, and it would be taken away. But with the Passover, well, he could do nothing. Because, you see, with the Passover, there was something much deeper going on. It was a plague on the firstborn, and it started with a sacrifice. It started with a sacrifice, the sacrifice of a lamb without defect, the sacrifice of a lamb without fault. A lamb whose blood would save Israel. A lamb who enabled the people of God to be free. A sacrificial lamb. Does it ring a bell? A sacrifice which seemed so small but pointed to so much. The sacrifice of a lamb whose place would later be taken by Jesus. The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. There was something much more powerful going on in the Passover, and Pharaoh could do absolutely nothing about it. Do you know, it reminds me of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Brilliant book. And the scene that always used to make me cry when I was a little girl, when Aslan came head to head with the witch. The moment we had been waiting for. The moment when we saw who was the most powerful. And to my horror, as a little girl, Aslan the lion was defeated, shaved and beaten and laughed at and spat on and tied up and killed. I remember watching the old cartoon and I cried because I loved Aslan. And he was killed. And Susan and Lucy are watching all that's happening behind the trees. And the book says they are distraught. They cry and cry and cry and cry all night because their dear Aslan has been killed by the witch. And then they go to investigate. They go to comfort Aslan. They go to sit with his body. They go to see what they can do. And they find the mice who are gnawing away at the ropes to try and release him. And so they untie a few of the ropes, and then it starts to get cold. And then they just don't know what to do, so they decide to go. And as they're going, they hear a loud crack and a bang. And they're frightened. And they say, "What was that? Do you know what that was?" And they turn around and they go back. And the table which Aslan's body was lying on is broken in two. And he's gone. And then they hear someone speak. And this is what it says in the book. "Oh, Aslan," cried both the children, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. "Aren't you dead then, dear Aslan?" said Lucy. "Not now," said Aslan. "You're not a, asked Susan in a shaky voice. She couldn't bring herself to say the word ghost. Aslan stooped his golden head and licked her forehead. The warmth of his breath and the rich sort of smell that seemed to hang about her hair came all over her. "Do I look it?" he said. "Oh, you're real, you're real. Oh, Aslan," cried Lucy, and both girls flung themselves upon him and covered him with kisses. "But what does it all mean?" asked Susan, when they were a little bit calmer. "It means," said Aslan, "that though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who has committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards." There was a deeper magic, or as we might like to change it to, a deeper force, a deeper thing going on. And it is this which defies Pharaoh in the final plague. It is this which makes the Passover the defining moment in Israelite history. It is this which could never have been beaten. However hard Pharaoh were to try with all his power and might, it was this sacrifice which could never have been undone. Because you see, in this plague and this plague only, the sacrifice of a lamb was made. But you know, there's also something else which makes it Israel's defining moment. Because also in this plague and this plague only, the people of Israel for the first time actually get involved. They follow instructions. They slaughter a lamb. They distribute meat. They cook the meat. They're careful not to break the bones. They gather together and they participate. For the first time in all the dealings with Pharaoh, the people of Israel don't just stand by hoping that they won't die, but they get involved. They actually hear the plans of God and they get involved with the sacrifice of the lamb. And when they do that, and only when they do that, they guarantee their own freedom as the people of God. Only when they get involved. And you know, today, although we don't really understand what the Passover would have been like because we weren't there, we do know what it means. I mean, you know, we only have to look in the Old Testament. We only have to read the pages of the Exodus. We only have to see the people of Israel. We only have to take interest in the Passover instructions. And we make the connection, don't we, between the Passover lamb and the Lamb of God. Between the passage here and Jesus Christ. Between the lamb that defeated Pharaoh and the Lamb of God who has defeated the power of sin and death. We make the connection in our minds. This is the heart of our faith. This is what we celebrated this morning. This is the sacrifice of Jesus. The deeper magic, the deeper force which travels through time. Rooting us, changing us, freeing us, enabling us to be the people of God today. It's at the heart of our faith. It's what we come to Jesus to find. The problem is that making this connection, having the knowledge that Jesus sacrificed his life for us, being aware of what he has done, remembering his death and resurrection, partaking each month in communion, well, it isn't really enough. Any more than it was enough for the people of Israel to stand by and watch as God produced all the plagues. Because watching didn't release Israel from slavery. And sitting back today, dabbling a little maybe, waiting for freedom, waiting for change, is not going to release us either into the new life that Jesus desired for us all to live. That's only going to happen when we participate, when we get involved, when we hear the message of God, when we get involved with the life of Jesus, and when we get involved with the death of Jesus. When we get involved to the point that we lay our lives before the cross and we say, "Here I am. Do whatever you will with my life, whatever it costs, whatever it takes." When we get involved to the point that we have our coats on and our shoes on and we're ready to go wherever he asks. Do you know, the other week, I watched the Great North Run highlights on telly. For obvious reasons, didn't see you, but, you know, thought I'd give it a go. And one thing struck me as I was sitting there. There were a number of people interviewed after they'd run, and they said, "I've never run before, I've never done this." And the interviewer would go, "Well, why are you doing it now?" And they'd go, well, my friend's son died, and I wanted to do something. Well, my close friend died, and I wanted to run. Well, my mum was supposed to be doing it, but she died, and I wanted to do it instead. And there were so many people who were doing this race because someone had died, who they knew, who they'd been involved with, and they wanted to do something. They wanted to somehow do something for this person, in memory of this person, and it motivated them to do it. Because, you see, death often has that effect on us. But, you know, the thing is, sacrifice has an even greater effect. Because sacrifice is designed to bring freedom. But only if we have the guts to get involved. Only if we have the courage to truly participate in what Jesus has done. Let's pray together.